This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 12th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One at Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. Coming up, we'll be discussing China's brain drain as Beijing steps up its scheme to attract the world's brightest academics. And all aboard to Afghanistan, the first Afghan railroad opens up the country's borders to the wider region to boost the economy. And we look at the art of stuffing animals and why so many creatives seem to be attracted by it. And I'll be hearing from Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, about the new African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa. As always, though, we'll have some great music amongst it all right here in the next hour on Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. But first, let's get the news from around the world with David Hedges.
Monocle 24 News at 6 o'clock. United States President Barack Obama says he is very concerned about the safety of U.S. personnel in Afghanistan following a U.S. soldier opening fire and killing 16 civilians. The Pentagon is withholding the identity of the American soldier being investigated until charges are filed. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said she is shocked and saddened by what has happened. 9 children were among those killed in the shootings in villages near a base in Kandahar. At a news conference this afternoon, ahead of a visit to the United States, British Prime Minister David Cameron told reporters Allied forces must stick to their plan and stay on course.
It is worth remembering why we're in Afghanistan. We're there to train up the Afghan army and the police so that that country is able to look after its own security and make sure that country isn't a haven for terrorists without having foreign troops on its soil. That's what we all dearly want.
United Nations Arab League envoy Kofi Annan will meet representatives of the opposition Syrian National Council in Ankara, Turkey tomorrow. Annan held talks over the weekend with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in a bid to negotiate an end to the bloodshed. Today, dozens of civilians have been killed in the city of Homs. Both the government of President Bashar al-Assad and his opponents have confirmed at least 45 women and children are thought to have been stabbed and burned in the district. Syrian state television is blaming terrorist armed groups for the attacks. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said he is extremely worried by a flare-up in violence between Israel and Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. He said rocket attacks on Israeli civilians were unacceptable and urged Israel to exercise maximum restraint. Israeli airstrikes killed 2 Palestinian militants and wounded 25 civilians in the Strip as cross-border hostilities continued into a fourth day. A paralyzed British man who wants to be able to lawfully end his life has won the right to have his case heard by London's High Court. 58-year-old Tony Nicholson from the southwest of England has locked-in syndrome following a stroke in 2005. The UK's Ministry of Justice argues allowing assisted suicide would authorise murder and change the law governing it. His lawyer, Samo Shahal, says her client is seeking legal protection for any doctor who helps him end his life.
What Tony is seeking is a declaration that a doctor who helps him to die should have available to him a defence of necessity to murder. Tony, although he's mentally competent, he is too physically disabled to avail himself of the right of suicide.
Italian art experts believe they found a hidden work by Leonardo da Vinci hidden behind a fresco on the wall of Florence's City Hall. Using tiny probes, researchers have found pigment recognized as that used in da Vinci's Mona Lisa. The researchers say their work is not conclusive yet and further chemical analysis needs to be carried out. And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much for that, David. Now, just looking at the papers as they land on breakfast tables in New Zealand and Australia this morning, The Australian covers the Reinhardt Empire row with between Gina and her children, or at least all but one of her children. The latest happenings in court over this row over the trust fund, which owns 23.6% of the Hancock Prospecting Iron Empire. Gina says none of the plaintiffs, those being her children, have the requisite capacity or skill or knowledge or experience for that matter to administer the trust in the nature of the growing company. So all but one of Gina's children taking her to court for access and control of the trust, which holds 23% of shares in Hancock Prospecting. Looking at the press of New Zealand, low-cost carrier abandons its Christchurch experiment. This is AirAsia X's decision to withdraw services from between Christchurch and Malaysia. And customers will get their money back if they've already booked tickets. But Christchurch International Airport boss Jim Bolt says there will be a penalty imposed on AirAsia for withdrawing from the route early. Hadn't done too badly this route, 80% capacity, and it reached a peak in January. It had only been going for 4 months. Four times a week since last April. So not even a year, and it was running at 80% capacity. But AirAsia says it's running at a loss. It can't continue as it is. So apologies to customers, but they'll have to make alternative arrangements. And the New Zealand Herald has another aviation story. This is the Jet's dire cockpit alarm. This is a Fly Pacific Blues incident in 2010, in which warnings were sounded just after takeoff from Auckland. It was a Queenstown to Sydney flight, and the Auckland pilot took off too late, according to the Civil Aviation Authority. He took off after the twilight hours, in which putting the plane at risk. The pilot says there were safety checks that weren't taken place. The safety checks were overlooked, and that put the plane at risk. He's blaming errors on the company's part. Civil Aviation Authority personally taking him to court, though, over that. And looking back to the Australian now, and there's a warning that the price of carbon being charged around the world will put Australia at an unfair disadvantage. Australian companies being charged too much for carbon compared to their European counterparts. The price per tonne of carbon in Australia, $23 compared to Europe's $10. And just a quick look at the age as well, with the G20 summit, which is coming to Australia, likely to cost taxpayers $400 million. Still not decided where the summit will be held. Treasurer Wayne Swan wants it to be held in Brisbane. But Sydney and Melbourne are better placed security-wise to host the event. And that's where most of this money will go, on securing the event. We'll continue now with a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernecker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Great weather in Europe over the next couple of days. Sunshine across a large part of the continent will build temperatures possibly to as high as 24 degrees across southern France. The UK will enjoy more mild weather too, and the warmth will reach Austria, Hungary and Poland, but not until the second half of the week. In the meantime, in Western Russia, it's still winter. Tuesday's city outlook: in London, 16 degrees with a sunny afternoon, Zurich 13 degrees and sunny, Madrid 20 with sunshine, but in Moscow it's 2 below and it's snowing. North America, it's been an exceptionally mild winter. Spring is likely to be mild as well, and this week temperatures across many parts of the US will be much higher than normal for March. But it's not necessarily going to be that sunny if you're jetting off to, say, the Pacific coast. From British Columbia down to Northern California, at times cloudy and wet. Tuesday's city outlook: in San Francisco, 15 degrees with rain. Chicago, a very mild 18 degrees for March, but cloudy. New York City, 17 degrees, partly cloudy. In Montreal, 13 and rain. A quick look at some other world centres then. Believe it or not, it's warmer in the UK than in Hong Kong. It's been only around 14 degrees here recently. Next couple of days in Hong Kong, 16, cloudy with light rain showers. In Tokyo, cool, bright and fresh weather, 10 degrees. The evenings are very chilly, but if you're off to Sydney, it's looking great. 27 degrees, pretty much all week with sunshine. Enjoy. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernecker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomash. It's 18:09 here in London, 9 past 5 in the morning if you're waking up in Melbourne, Australia. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 highlights, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, you're welcome.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. Welcome back. Now, China's rise to prominence on the world stage, both economically and politically, has been widely documented. China's thirst for knowledge and its determination to progress is evident at US and European universities, where Chinese students make up a huge proportion of foreign entrants. Historically, many would settle in their country of study. But as the prospects back home start to outshine anything the West can offer, many are choosing to return to the motherland. And hot on their heels are the professors who taught them. As Western universities slash budgets and lay off staff, academics are being welcomed to China with open arms. Last year, the Chinese government launched the 1,000 Foreign Experts Programme, which it hopes will draw foreign academics and entrepreneurs over the next decade to help improve research and innovation. Now, on the line, we have Jeffrey S. Lehman, the founding den of the Peking University School of Transnational Law. Firstly, Jeffrey, why do you think China is keen to get more Western academics? Don't you have enough in China already?
Well, I think that part of what's interesting about working in China today is that there is just a tremendous hunger to integrate the society more effectively into the world at large. And although it's possible to do that progressively on your own, it's much more effective and efficient if you welcome people. I'm an American, and I think the U.S. historically has identified itself as a place that is open to people from all over the world, and that's been part of our strength.
Your department at Peking, I mean, Peking's been noted as one of the universities really driving this luring of minds from the West over to China. What specifically do you look for to take over to China?
Well, our school is a very special kind of school. The idea for this school was the idea of a vice president of Peking University, who happens to be an economist, who studied in the U.S. and was a member of a U.S. faculty for many years before returning home. Our school is called the School of Transnational Law, and although China has 630 law schools, almost all of them are patterned on continental European schools. That is to say, they're mostly taught by lecture about theory. And Haiwan thought it would be good to add into the mix an experimental school that would look much more like an American law school. That is to say, the students would all be at the graduate level. The courses would be taught in English. We teach the common law using the Socratic method, with the goal of developing a set of lawyerly intellectual skills. And so he approached me in 2007 and said, do you think it's possible for us to create a school like this in South China in the city of Shenzhen? And so I said, sure, let's give it a try.
Are there any specific schools that you have your eye on in terms of luring people away from? Is there like a badge of honor in poaching people from the Ivy League schools or from Oxbridge?
Well, we don't actually poach. We have a lot of, most of our courses are actually taught by visiting faculty who have permanent appointments at top American law schools. And they come and they teach a concentrated course in the space of 6 weeks. And then they return happily to their home school, having had a good China experience. And our students have the benefit of having had great teachers.
Do you need to incentivize this to get people interested? I mean, the pay on offer, I'm reading vast sums being offered to the highest end of academia, £16,000 a month being offered to some academics. Obviously, not every job would attract such a salary, but do you need to throw a carrot their way to get them to go over to China?
No, our standard salaries actually are lower than the comparable salaries for permanent positions at American law schools. The number we use is 70%. Salaries at American law schools right now are quite comfortable, and people are interested in having the opportunity to study, to teach and to have a China experience. And so people get I guess I would say, a certain amount of psychic income above and beyond what they earn in cash.
Looking beyond Peking University and what the Chinese government's launched in this 1,000 foreign experts program, it's quite timely, isn't it, given the circumstances over in the West economically. I'm sure many people, compared to 5 years ago, would be more than willing to relocate to the other side of the world if it meant that they can maintain their lifestyle or maybe enjoy an even better one. Rather than, you know, when times were good in the US and Europe, they'd be settled. No reason to move. Things have changed, though, haven't they?
Well, I don't think the point of these programs is to give people incentives to move, to increase their material quality of life. That's not the goal. The goal is to try to make things more comparable to the quality of life that people had home materially, and then to supplement that with, I guess, what I would say is a kind of a sense of adventure to participate in building something new. At the end of the Cultural Revolution, which was only 35 years ago, higher education was really in very sad shape in China, and they're working very hard to move it to international standards very, very quickly.
Looking at other countries and their efforts to attract students from the West and academics from the West, who would you say are China's biggest threats now? Are the Latin American nations like Brazil posing quite a threat? I'm sure quite a few Europeans, perhaps from Portugal, would be more likely to go to Brazil than they would to China. Who are you competing against now to attract the best minds?
Well, I think with the experience of globalization right now, I think there's a lot of attractive places. People are curious about moving outside their home territories in a way that they might not have been 20 years ago. I think many, many spots in the world are now looking to try to attract faculty from abroad to come add diversity to the experience that they're offering their students, which is, of course, a great way to prepare them for the lives that they'll be experiencing in this century.
Lastly, Jeffrey, from your experience of coming from America and then going to university in China, what are the differences and what can you achieve and what knowledge can you glean from going to China and working for their universities compared to other parts of the world?
Well, I think for me, the rise of China in the past 30 years is one of the most fascinating miracles of human history. I think it's the largest country in the world, 5,000-year-old civilization, and it is blessed with enormous human talent. And so for me, it's really been a very exciting new set of experiences. I spent the early part of my career, I should say, focused on Europe. I spent 2 years living in France. And this has been a very, very interesting, refreshing, and enjoyable change for me.
Jeffrey, all the best with it. Thank you for that. That was Jeffrey S. Lehman, the founding dean of the Peking University School of Transnational Law, joining us there. You're listening to Majori House on Monocle 24. Stay tuned. We'll be talking about the railroad to success for Afghanistan. Just a moment.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and again how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
Welcome back. back. It's 19 minutes past the hour here at Midori House. Now, we turn to Afghanistan, where the country's first railroads just opened. Half a dozen more train lines are planned by Afghan authorities in a sign the country's keen to oil the wheels of its economy. The Afghan monarchy banned the construction of railroads in the last 19th century, fearing they opened the door to British or Russian occupation during the Great Game. It staved off an invasion, but it also hampered economic growth, leaving Afghanistan isolated during the railroad boom time. Now, Afghanistan is hoping to position itself at the centre of a new Silk Route. They're inviting other countries to build tracks and weave the region together, something the US hopes will bring much-needed stability to Afghanistan and its neighbours. I'm joined in the studio now by Andrew Grantham, the news editor of Railway Gazette International. Evening, Andrew. How are you?
Okay.
Firstly, why do you think there is a new railway opened in Afghanistan? It's been open a month now. Why did that open and why so late?
Most of the international trade of Afghanistan now goes in and out through the northern border because of the difficulties with the route south through Pakistan. And something like half the imports and exports of Afghanistan pass through one bridge, which was a road and rail bridge that just served a freight terminal on customs point on the Afghan side of the border. But it was in the middle of nowhere and not a good location. So by building a railway to Mazar-i-Sharif, the nearest big city, it essentially moves the point goods arrive in the country from a border point in the middle of the desert to a major city. So a much more useful place to do business.
And this is significant because it connects Afghanistan now with its neighbours.
Yes, it's a direct connection to Uzbekistan, and from Uzbekistan you have rail links to the rest of the world, in effect.
Do you see this having a sweeping change on Afghanistan as we know it now?
I don't think it will have a sweeping change in the short term, but it will be good for the local region. It will be good for business. It will support trade. There was a feasibility study done. They went out and asked people in the local villages, what do you think of the scheme for building the railway? And the responses were almost universally, how soon can you do it? And will it be useful for my small business?
And what had held it back historically was xenophobia, it seems.
I think, to a certain extent, the Afghan leadership were generally right in their fears that if they allowed the British Empire to build a railway from what is now Pakistan or the Russian Empire to come in from the north, sooner or later it would end up with Afghanistan either becoming a battleground between the British and Russian empires or being annexed. And from the Afghan point of view, that's probably quite a reasonable thing to be worried about.
Now, looking at the countries wanting to be involved in the construction of new lines, Afghanistan's attracting them and inviting them, should I say, to have a part in this. Why might they be so interested in getting involved in this?
There's a lot of natural resources in Afghanistan, but traditionally it's been almost impossible to extract them simply because of the lack of transport infrastructure. And there's a lot of iron ore, but iron ore is a very bulky, heavy commodity, and it's not much use in the middle of nowhere. And whereas places like Brazil and Australia have built quite ambitious rail networks to get it out, in Afghanistan there just isn't the infrastructure to do that. And India, China, countries like that have got an eye on the natural resources, and there's a lot of money to be made for Afghanistan and for the people extracting it if there's the transport network to support this.
And we mentioned the infrastructure that's already in place. Will this have an impact on passenger travel at all at this stage, or will it for the foreseeable future remain very much a freight network?
I think for the foreseeable future it will be freight. There are facilities for passenger traffic, but that will probably be quite small for the foreseeable future.
Will this help maintain and improve and build on relations that Afghanistan has with its neighbours like Pakistan?
I think so, yes, we can hope so. And certainly Iran is investing a lot of money in Herat and Western Afghanistan, which it has strong historical cultural links to. And the Iranians are building a railway to Herat. They're putting roads, electricity infrastructure. And I think there's an explicit aim from their point of view to increase links. And the northern regions around the Uzbek-Tajik border, there are strong cultural historical ties. The border is perhaps a bit arbitrary, and it will increase trade from the people in that region who tend to perhaps look more north and south.
And you touched on a couple of the big commodities in Afghanistan. We've mentioned silk and iron ore. Some of the other big ones where the money is copper. Any others that Afghanistan can now railroad out of the country?
There's an interest in gems, that sort of thing, but that's probably a much smaller market. But copper is perhaps the biggest commodity, with the Chinese looking at building a railway through Central Asia down into Afghanistan to access a huge copper deposit south of Kabul, or alternatively going out through Pakistan. And they're looking at both options at the moment.
When you're looking at other countries, maybe in a similar position to Afghanistan, how important is building a railroad? It's not a cheap option, and road would serve both passengers and freight. It might be stating the obvious, but in this day and age, is there still advantage to having rail networks over road?
Yes, particularly if you're looking at moving bulk freight, something like an iron ore train, you can have one driver and a train. I mean, places like Australia run trains over a mile long. You can just move huge amounts of stuff fairly cheaply, certainly cheaper than road, and with a lot less damage to things like road infrastructures. Maintaining roads to the same standard would be quite a big job.
And this railroad that's just opened, it's the first of quite a long line of projects now. Do you have any idea of the schedule they're looking at now?
The next project is likely to be a line across the border from Turkmenistan, which the Turkmen government is funding itself. And Turkmenistan already has a very short connection, but it's in the absolute middle of nowhere, and they're quite keen to build another one. And then the Asian Development Bank is looking at funding linking up these two projects. Iran is building a line to Herat. Now, interestingly, that's to a different gauge, the distance between the rails, which means they're incompatible. But the Asian Development Bank wants to then join up these two projects, so that will effectively create a corridor from Central Asia to Herat. Then Herat will be linked to Iran, the Gulf, Turkey, potentially Europe. And this will be quite exciting because it will give the Central Asian countries a route to the Indian Ocean and the rest of the world, which, without being dependent on Russia. So for the first time ever, these countries will have a link to the rest of the world without having to be nice to Russia.
Knock on Russia's door.
Yes. Absolutely.
It's quite a strategic location, isn't it? And it's mind-blowing how quickly it's all happening. Andrew Grantham, thank you very much for that. That was Andrew Grantham from Railway Gazette International. Now, you're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a moment. First, though, we'll have some music. This is Time in Mind by the Two Bears.
It wasn't you, the angel on my mind. In the end, I wasn't sad to leave behind. Time in mind. You're not in a cell, there ain't no screws, but you'll find your conscience giving it to you. It goes
doop-de-doop, indeed. That was Time in Mind by the Two Bears. You're listening to Midori House, live on Monocle 24.
LDN TYO NYC MT4.
In the next half hour on Midori House, we continue the railway theme. This time we hear how reindeer herders in Swedish Lapland are having problems with a new high-speed link. We also hear how taxidermy, or stuffing and mounting animals, is enjoying something of a renaissance. But first, here's David Hedges with the news headlines.
United States President Barack Obama says he is very concerned about the safety of U.S. personnel in Afghanistan following a U.S. soldier opening fire and killing 16 civilians. The Pentagon is withholding the identity of the American soldier being investigated until charges are filed. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said she is shocked and saddened by what has happened. 9 children were among those killed in the shootings in villages near a base in Kandahar. United Nations Arab League envoy Kofi Annan will meet representatives of the opposition Syrian National Council in Ankara, Turkey tomorrow. Annan held talks over the weekend with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in a bid to negotiate an end to the bloodshed in the city of Homs. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said he is extremely worried by a flare-up in violence between Israel and Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. He said rocket attacks on Israeli civilians were unacceptable and urged Israel to exercise maximum restraint. A paralysed British man who wants to be able to lawfully end his life has won the right to have his case heard by London's High Court. 58-year-old Tony Nicholson from the southwest of England has locked-in syndrome following a stroke in 2005. He's seeking legal protection for any doctor who helps him end his life. Italian art experts believe they found a hidden work by Leonardo da Vinci hidden behind a fresco on the wall of Florence's City Hall. Using tiny probes, researchers have found pigment recognises that used in Da Vinci's Mona Lisa. And those are the headlines here in Monocle 24.
Thank you, David. Now, rail, as we've heard just a second ago, is often heralded as the answer to an area's economic problems, the path to prosperity. Usually opposition surrounds the noise, the construction, the spoiled landscape around it. But a new high-speed rail link in northern Sweden's angered local reindeer farmers. More than 200 reindeer have been killed on the tracks since the line opened just 3 months ago. Joining me now on the line is Tobias Jonsson, a reindeer farmer in Mikkelträsk, a village of 50 or so people in Swedish Lapland. Tobias, how are you, sir?
I'm good.
In your own words, Tobias, what's happening around this rail line?
Yeah, this rail line has recently opened. It's been down for several years. And they put in the trains. They travel very fast. Mm. These new trains travel fast after the rail. So they've been killing a lot of reindeers.
And there's nothing to stop them from wandering on there, is there? There's no fencing at all.
No fencing, and in this particular winter, they have the conditions of the grazing has been harsh, so they've been wandering a lot.
They've been walking around more than usual.
More than usual, and that's the. The snow has been over a meter, so and on the railway it's about 10 centimetres, so it's easy to walk after the rail.
If a farmer loses one of their reindeers, what is there any compensation offered by the train company or the council? What happens?
Yes, the train company, they offer about 3,000 Swedish crowns as compensation, but it's not nearly enough.
I mean, a reindeer farmer, they've invested an awful lot in their animals, and their value is, I'm sure, much greater than that. How badly can this affect a farmer? Can it put them out of business?
Yes, it can put them out of business, but the thing that's the worst, it's the psychological aspect of this. It's when you get these messages or calls on the phone of, there been a train hitting the herds. You can't describe the feeling you got inside, and it's awful. Oof.
It's like losing a pet or a family member.
Yes, exactly. It's like losing you see them every day in the winter, so you know which one. When you come in the morning, you know which ones whose train has killed.
How can you tell which ones are yours and which ones are other farmers? Because they all have such freedom, don't they, to roam around. And that seems to be one of the problems with these lines.
Yes, but you know, we herd them in the wintertime, so we separate our herds from each other. And how we can tell, they got brands in their ears, so we know if someone has come over from the neighbours and so, but that happens all the time.
When you drive through the area as well, you do often see reindeer just wandering or just gathered in the middle of the road, and it's a part of living around there. It's something you accept, isn't it? But these trains obviously stop for nothing, and they go past regardless. Can reindeer, do you think, coexist with these trains? They have a tendency to just wander and roam free, and they don't have awareness of these trains. Can they ever live in harmony together, do you think?
Yes, they can, but it takes a huge effort from those who construct those lines, or those train lines. They huge effort. You have to build some bridges which they can pass over, and not only fences, because the fences, when you put up a fence in the landscape, you break the grazing pattern, and you stop them from moving in a natural pattern, and it's not good. You can see that directly.
Yeah, that would be a simple solution, I'm sure, suggested by some people building fences. But as you say, it breaks their freedom to roam, and that's in their very much in their mindset. What is that part of their personality, being free and able to just wander? What would you describe the personality of your reindeer?
Oh, it's being free.
Being free.
Yes, being free, and you know, have no borders in roads or rails or something. It's just free, and grace, only freedom.
These trains, they can't be quiet. They must be pretty loud as they hurtle past. Why aren't they running away from these trains? Why aren't they scared of them?
Yes, they are scared, because but there are some things. They travel fast.
Mm.
Their reindeers can't run that fast, so they can't escape it. And then, you know, if in night time they come and they got the lights on, and when the lights hits the eyes of the reindeer, they don't know where to go, so they get a little bit paralyzed, so they just stand there. And you know, if on the rail, the depth of the snow is only 10 inches and 10 centimeters, and on the side maybe 1 meter thick.
Mm.
And you know, it's easy to run after the rail, but you know, the trains, they fetch them pretty fast.
What are herders doing now to sort of combat this, or you know, how are they dealing with this as they lose more and more reindeer? 200 in just a few months is an awful lot, and if you're losing your reindeer, what can you do?
Yes, they have this particular line that has caused so much trouble. The herders who were in that area, they have moved the reindeers to another area, and they are in much comes to much harsher conditions. But you know, they couldn't take this psychological aspect of this, having to have the reindeer so near the rail, the line.
Who will outlast who, do you think, the reindeer or the train lines? You can't move them too far. It's their indigenous area.
No. Yeah, who would outlast? You know, we have to have them nearby to graze every year. But you know, this aspect, you know, if the pressure on the herders become too harsh, you have to stop being a herder, and that's the end of it, the culture of this aspect.
Tobias, I do wish you all the best with that, and it's such a sad story to hear that your trade is being hampered by these lines. I do hope you can find somewhere that they're not disturbed like they are at the moment. That was Tobias Jansson, a reindeer farmer in Mikkeltrask in Swedish Lapland. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back with some music just after this.
With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world, this is Monocle 24.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in, and it introduces you to the planners, thinkers and architects who want to make urban life rattle along like a well-tended tram, not grind to halt like a taxi with a flat tire.
We see that our community is changing, and we have two alternatives. We could make it an eyesore in the community, or we can make it a shining jewel, and we chose to make it a shining jewel.
Leave the countryside to the softies and listen to the show that knows that a bit of grit and bustle is good for you. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24.
It's 18:41 here at Midori House in London, and joining me in the studio now is the senior editor of Monocle, Sophie Grove. She's poring over the newest issue of Monocle, the April 2012 issue. How are you, Sophie?
I'm great, thank you. It's looking very lovely.
It's beautiful. And we've got this Northern Lights picture of the Sami people, and I do like their outfits.
I know, they're very colourful.
Aren't they?
And very good looking, actually, this pair.
Aren't they? I'm
one
looking
of them's
at their
a rapper.
Eyes.
He's a Sami rapper.
Really?
Yeah.
Excellent.
It really is. I also did this story in...
Did you?
The piece you just did on the reindeer was very on theme.
On with
our
this
cover.
Story,
yeah.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of reindeer chat in the expo.
I'm not sure Tobias wears that, but I imagined him to look something like that.
Let's just imagine
reindeer.
Him.
Yeah,
in a green felt tunic, shall
That's
we?
That's Tobias. Now let's look at this story involving the African Nations' new headquarters in Ethiopia. It's quite a grand building, isn't it, Sophie?
It is. It's actually a $200 million building
vast.
In Addis Ababa, and it's vast. I mean, it does look like a sort of alien ship has just landed, because Addis isn't the most beautiful looking place, and it's kind of ramshackle, dusty. It's high altitude. It's really a mountainous city, but there isn't that much. It's a gleaming new, very pristine architecture, and this is like an absolute. You know, it's very slick. It's a marble tower, and then next to it, this enormous sort of vaulted bubble. Like structure, which
this
is
dome,
the plenary
yeah.
hall dome. So it's a very breathtaking building, surrounded by black marble, crazy fountains, and this gold life-size statue of Kwame Nkrumah, who was one of the great Pan-Africa kind of pioneers, who was also the president of Accra back in the 60s and 50s and 60s. So it's a really a huge addition to the skyline. Everyone is looking at it. Everyone's talking about it.
And you would wonder whether it was quite a stretch to afford this as a building until you hear that it was a gift by China.
It was an absolute lockstop gift from China, who,
how nice
who came and they built it with largely Chinese labour and almost completely Chinese materials that they shipped from Beijing. They were there for just over 2 years, so actually they did it pretty quickly, and it's very plush. I mean, inside it's white marble.
It's gorgeous.
Sweeping staircases, this VIP area upstairs,
and the assembly room, 2,500 capacity plenary hall,
all sort of clad in wood veneer, and
this
then
could be in New York City. It could be in London. It could
yeah,
be in Tokyo.
I mean, it was. It's funny because there were some aspects that you just thought. It was kind of soulless, the way that they labelled it. It just said things like medium-sized hall, as a thing, which was really great. And so there's a little bit, there's a lot of detail and attention to detail. You know, there's wonderful African mosaics and reliefs and you know, crests and insignias. Everything's there. You know, the Barcelona chairs, everything's very slick. But I wanted to let one of the African Union commissioners introduce this building and also sort of explain how it came about, this Sino-African alliance. So this is Ambassador Haile Fantahun, who's one of the project directors of this, who's been working since 2006 with the Chinese on it. So he can give us a little insight into how it came about.
Well, it came up about in 2006 when the then president of the African Union, President Konari, when he came in 2003 and he took up the responsibility of this organization, he found out that this organization didn't have the necessary office facilities that the African Union looked for, and the conference facility as well. Then he thought of undertaking the responsibility of expanding the African Union Commission in order to have the necessary facilities that it was lacking, the office and the conference. Then he discussed it with the host country, Ethiopia, for provision of additional plots of land for that expansion. And luckily enough, next to it, this was a central prison house of the country. And that time, the city government of Addis was about to close the central prison house because it was a symbol of terror and harassment and killing of people in the country. So the Ethiopian government was about to close that central prison. So it coincided well with requests that it came up from the African Union. So about 130,000 square meters of land was given to the African Union. Then, of course, the issue of finance was a very critical one. President Konari wanted to go to one of the partners of Africa, because at that time it would have been very difficult to secure such an amount of money from member states, given to the economic problems that most of our countries had faced during that time. Then, of course, by coincidence, he went to China. He brought to the attention of the government of China, and the government of China agreed in principle to provide the necessary financial support for the expansion of the African Union Commission.
So that was Haile Fantahun explaining sort of the origins of the project and that collaboration.
Very interesting as well about the prison and the site on which this building was placed upon, and many saying that there should have been a memorial on the side of this awful prison that it's replaced.
Exactly. There's a prison, an octagonal-shaped prison built by Italian colonists in 1936, which was then taken over by Haile Selassie, who was one of the emperors of Ethiopia. And it was really used as a you know, place to kind of keep political prisoners. Then the Dirge took it over, the Marxist regime that came after him. And so some people are saying, look, this is awful symbolism. We need a memorial here, not the African Union Plenary Hall, which is almost exactly on the place
literally outlined on it. Yeah.
And the African Union doesn't have the best reputation. It's known as this kind of dictator's club. And they really need to... They're trying to move away from that. And there's a lot of rhetoric saying Africa for Africans. This is a new start. This building reflects something completely different. Other people are saying, no, it doesn't. You know, you've just bulldozed the past. You haven't commemorated it at all. And then obviously there are questions, and we look at this in the article, the diplomatic implications of this. You know, what does China
Absolutely.
Want?
Is there such a thing as a gift? And are there strings attached to this?
I mean, there... bilateral trade relationship is $150 billion a year. So they really have a big presence in Africa. Africa is a very big and strategical player in the sort of growth of the Chinese economy, and you know the way that China is going abroad and looking for business abroad, not least their sort of resources, and they definitely have an eye on that. So it will be interesting to see how this building affects those relationships, and also to see the other players. There's a, as we talk about in the piece, there's a German facility being built right next door, and it's a whole other story.
Wow.
Almost an allegory for sort of another interaction and another donor, benefactor,
yes,
or collaborator, partner in the African Union story. So it's kind of, this story is so emblematic of so many different things and power, like geopolitical things that are happening in Africa at the moment.
We'll try to keep a hand in there. Sophie, thank you so much for that. So if you'd like to read more about that, it's in Section A of the April 2012 edition of Monocle, page 33, Special Relations. Thank you so much, Sophie Grove, Monocle's senior editor. We're going to go to a song now. This is Bicycle by Memory Tapes. That song was Bicycle by Memory Tapes. Now, Mamma Mia star Amanda Seyfried has declared her love for stuffed animals. The actress says she's a huge fan of taxidermy. Her own collection includes an owl and a miniature pony. While showbiz journalists feast on this unexpected nugget of nonsense, a new series of lectures in London this month is helping the public rekindle its love for the lost art of taxidermy. During the Victorian era, taxidermy illustrated man's superiority over animal. From a 40-foot whale shark in Karachi to Fido the feisty suburban feline, creatures great and small are still stuffed for showmanship, study, or posterity for those lucky enough to inherit
heart, such a creature. Joining me on the line now is Dr. Pat Morris, who's leading the lecture entitled History of Taxidermy, Art, Science and Bad Taste. Dr. Morris, welcome firstly. Where does the art and practice of taxidermy originate from?
Well, good evening. First of all, it depends when you date and how you define taxidermy. Mm. But if you say that it is the art of preserving animals in representation of life, then that removes discussion of Egyptian mummies, for example.
Right.
And it brings us much more up to date to somewhere around in the 1600s when people were making explorations all around the world, collecting stuff, you know, not just animals, but all sorts of other things, and bringing them back to the museums and noblemen of Europe. And preserving birds particularly was a bit of a challenge which people wanted to do.
One of the questions that intrigued me to start with was, are there any creatures that we cannot stuff and preserve?
There are some which are not a very successful, shall we say.
Right.
I mean, an octopus doesn't stuff well.
Oh, what a shame.
but generally speaking, birds and mammals and even humans can be prepared using standard techniques which have been widely used for the last 200-300 years.
And going back historically, any religions in particular or cultures that really embraced it more than others?
No, it's not a religious thing. It's cultural, yes, in the sense that in this country, for example, taxidermy was a very important part of the history of natural history. Mm. You know, stuffed birds were and study skins were a very important tool for understanding variation within species, classification, how to recognise things, and modern field guides are based upon collections of that kind of stuff. But at the same time, there was also a very strong interest in taxidermy in Britain for decorative purposes. You know, people would like to have stuffed birds, bright coloured objects in the household, much as we might hang a travel poster on the wall today.
It is an intersection between art and science, isn't it? And I wonder how one becomes a taxidermist, whether you have to follow a scientific path or whether you can take it from an artistic perspective. What's the training regime for somebody who wants to stuff animals?
Most people learn taxidermy by making it up as they go along, or doing as I did, and trying to follow the instructions in a book.
Oh, right.
And of course, that is a bit of a hit and miss procedure, but you get better as time goes by. And some taxidermists never improved, and their work is still around, and it's still pretty awful. Others practice and practice and practice and make perfect. And in this country, we have a guild of taxidermists, some of whom do absolutely brilliant work.
Looking at the 20th century, aside from in the classroom and helping science students study, you can imagine the hunters in rural areas parading their stuffed animals on the plinth to show that they've it's a trophy, isn't it? Essentially, look what I've managed to hunt down. Why though would middle class people living in cities want to stuff animals? What's the inspiration these days?
Well, these days you'll have to ask the people who buy this sort of thing. It's no good asking me, but in the past, people have certainly wanted to have these things as a decorative object in the household and a reminder of the wonders of nature outside, particularly, you know, when city houses are so dull and boring. I mean, I used to live in the East End of London and we never saw any live animals there. Only dead ones in the museum, and they were a source of, you know, continual fascination for me. Otherwise, you see things, as you say, like hunting trophies, particularly fox hunting trophies, hanging in large houses and also in the pub and hotels and places like that. Fishing trophies, you know, that's another whole school of taxidermy, if you like, focused on angling, which again was very London-oriented as well. So there's a whole different kind of sets of clients, if you like, all with their own different motives for buying this sort of thing. And I'm sure the same principle applies today.
And largely, lastly, Dr. Morris, is there a one particular creature or is there a trend now, a specific type of animal that people are looking for?
No, I mean, always there have been some things which have been more popular, owls, for example, and birds of prey, all of which are very strictly protected by law these days, and you can't go out just collecting these things willy-nilly. people collect pets as well. You know, sometimes they want their pets preserved. Other people are horrified at the very idea.
As am I. I must leave it there, Dr. Morris. I must leave it there. I'm ever so sorry. Dr. Pat Morris, who's leading a lecture called History of Taxidermy. Thank you very much. We're out of time for this edition of Midori House. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 London time to start the day in Asia. Goodbye.